Welcome this morning as part of our Portrait Class program. Students from Altoona High School, would they stand, please? Welcome. Please be seated. The Court with Class, a program that's run by the Supreme Court and the State Bar, has won two national awards. As the students know, they've received materials about the case we're about to hear and may have had people come in and talk about this case. So we're delighted to have you. And at noon, retired Chief Justice Day will meet with the students and anyone else who wishes to be in the courtroom, and we'll discuss the procedures in the Supreme Court. Now that we've met you, I would like to introduce you to the court. On my having a little feedback. On my far left is Justice David Prosser. Next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is an empty chair, but usually sitting in it is Justice Donald Steinmetz. He is not participating on this case, so that's why he's not here. To now my second right is Justice John Wilcox, and on the far right is Justice Patrick Crooks. With those introductions made, we'll call the first case, 95-1067, State of Wisconsin versus John Watson. Sally Wellman, Assistant Attorney General, represents the state. Ms. Wellman.
Good morning, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Sally Wellman, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state, which is the petitioner in this case. This is a Chapter 980 case. In this case, the state seeks an involuntary civil commitment of Mr. Watson as a sexually violent person. In order to commit Mr. Watson as a sexually violent person under Chapter 980, the state at trial will have to prove that he has been convicted of a sexually violent offense, that he suffers a mental disorder which predisposes him to engage in acts of sexual violence, and that as a result of his mental disorder, he is dangerous in that the mental disorder makes it substantially probable that he will engage in acts of sexual violence. At the probable cause hearing in this, the issues in this case revolve around the probable cause hearing in this case. It's the state's position that Dr. Althaus, a clinical psychologist, was properly permitted to testify to his expert opinion that the false imprisonment in this case, which was Mr. Watson's prior offense, was sexually motivated. This evidence was properly admitted, and it established probable cause to believe that Mr. Watson is a sexually violent person, thus permitting the case to go forward. The evidence was properly admitted and can be relied upon to establish probable cause of sexual motivation, because in Wisconsin, expert testimony is admissible if it's relevant, if the expert is qualified, and if the testimony would assist the trier of fact to understand the evidence or to determine a fact in issue. In this case, the controversy centers around the assisting the jury or assisting the finder of fact. There's no suggestion that Dr. Althaus was not a qualified clinical psychologist.
Do you know, counsel, the origin of the statement in question? It's in the PSI, but who was that statement made to originally? How did it get in there? Do you know that?
I don't believe that is entirely clear from the record. It appears that it is a statement of the victim presented to the PSI author.
Okay, the author of the PSI.
Author of the PSI.
Was that statement, was there a full trial on this particular false imprisonment charge?
No, it went down on a plea, so there was not a trial.
Was there a trial on the other false imprisonment charge?
No, I believe he pled to all of the charged offenses in the regarding the 1980 offenses.
Were there preliminary examinations?
I'm assuming so, but that is not in the record in this case, nor is the guilty plea transcript in the record.
Judge Bartel, the trial court judge that's the opinion that is the subject of this review was involved in the initial false imprisonment charges in 1980. To what extent was that involvement, do you know?
She definitely was the sentencing judge, and my recollection is that she was also the judge who took the plea. I don't think there's anything in the record to tell us whether she was involved prior to that or not.
Ms. Wellman, as I remember evidence from way back, it used to be that when an expert witness was asked an opinion, all the facts upon which the opinion was based had to have been proved in the case. It's also my understanding that law of evidence has changed.
That's correct.
Okay. So what we have here today, at least as I see it, is you've got the expert witness testifying on the basis of a factual premise, namely what the defendant said to the victim. That factual premise has not been proved under our rules of evidence. That factual premise appears in the pre-sentence investigation report. That's the PSI, right?
Yes.
And that pre-sentence investigation report is made up by a parole or probation officer on the basis of investigation. And the defendant can seize that and can object to anything in it, right? And
right.
The defendant here objected to this report of his statement, right?
Of that statement, yes.
Okay. So, is the issue before you whether or not there was sufficient evidence for a trial judge to say there's probable cause because the expert opinion is based on a fact that's not in evidence, that's not been fully proved? Is that what the issue is here?
I think the issue is whether the expert's opinion was properly admitted. I read the Court of Appeals decision as basically saying it wasn't properly admitted in the first place because it wasn't a proper subject of expert testimony because it's not the kind of thing that experts rely upon.
What experts rely on?
Well, I'm not entirely sure from the court's opinion what it is. I think that I'm not sure if they mean just the hearsay statement, the statement of the victim, or if they mean also the contents of a pre-sentence report. They seem troubled that it is, that is a piece of information that the expert relied on, and they don't break it out further than that.
Well, let's just get away from the Court of Appeals for the moment. What do you think the issue is?
I think the issue is whether the trial court erred in concluding that it could not find probable cause because, as she said, she had the expert opinion on sexual motivation, but the evidence or information underlying that opinion had not been admitted. And on that, we believe she was clearly wrong because that's exactly what 90703 permits. It permits an expert to give an opinion based on either evidence that is in the record or evidence outside the record that need not be admissible.
That's where we started off.
Yes.
My conversation with you.
Yes.
Unlike the old
Unlike
law.
Unlike the common law. It absolutely replaces the common law.
Right. So, is the state's position that any time an expert witness testifies as to facts that are not been admitted, that you have to accept that expert witness?
When the expert testifies to an opinion,
right,
based on information or data or facts upon which experts reasonably rely in the field, which the expert in this case said that he did, and it was the trial court admitted it on that basis, then in a probable cause situation, yes, because that provides a plausible account, which is all that's necessary at probable cause. Now, obviously, at trial, the finder of fact is not bound to accept that opinion. They may find that the opinion is invalid. They may think he's not a very good psychologist. They may have contrary opinions from other experts produced by either the state or the defense. And so, of course, it's not binding on the ultimate trier of fact, but at the probable cause hearing, it is because it provides a plausible basis to believe he's a sexually violent person on that aspect.
So even if the expert opinion was based on a fact that was scientifically wrong, the he found it in the PSI. I mean, we can try and make something up. Then the trial court is bound by that expert opinion for probable cause.
If it's the type of information that experts ordinarily rely on, reasonably rely on in the course of their profession, I think it's important here to back up just a half a step and make it clear that it's also our position that the expert's opinion in this case was not solely or only based on the statement, in the sense that he excluded everything else he knew when he rendered this opinion. He never said any such thing. In fact, he initially said, my opinion is based in part on the statement attributed to the victim in the pre-sentence report.
Right. I was going to say that's the position that the dissent took in the appellate court, that you have to look at the total situation of the fact that there was 2.5 hours of actual, let's say, interrogation or visitation by the Dr. Allhouse with the with Mr. Watson, as well as the Sharp test, which on its face, I believe, indicated the conclusion that he came to, unless I'm wrong.
That's right. He had reviewed all of the file materials. He had reached a diagnosis of paraphilia, and that's very significant because the paraphilia itself consists of a recurring pattern of uncontrollable urges to have sexual contact with non-consenting persons. In fact, when he was asked the question on direct examination, the question the prosecutor asked was, doctor, based on your training, education, and experience, your conversations with Mr. Watson, your review of all the written materials that you have testified to, did you form an opinion to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty as to whether count 3, the false imprisonment, was a sexually motivated offense? The question assumes that he's using all of his expertise, all of his training, his experience, his education, and he's considering everything that he knows about this person, the background, and the interviews. He said, it's my professional opinion, based on my experience, the offense was sexually motivated. And frankly, I think if that was all that we had in this record, the issue would never have come up in this case. I think it got confused, perhaps, because on cross-examination, the doctor was asked, the defense counsel says, now as I understand it, your opinion as to sexual motivation for the false imprisonment in 1980 rests entirely on this one statement. And he said, yes. Then on redirect, he was asked, did you consider the statement? Yes. And he was asked, did you also consider the rest of the incidents of the rest of the facts of that incident? And he said, yes. Then on further cross, he was asked, assuming that statement wasn't made, would that change your opinion that the false imprisonment charge was sexually motivated if all you had was the rest of the information about the beating and so on? And he said, if I didn't have that statement, it would be virtually impossible to draw that conclusion. And then defense counsel said, and that's because the facts suggested don't, I mean, there's no sexual touching or any attempt, is that correct? And he said, yes. So I think when you look at the entire record, at most you have some inconsistencies. And I think a fair way to read the doctor's opinion and saying it was based entirely on the statement is that that's the only overt situational indicator I have, not, and he was never, certainly never asked, when you're reaching this opinion, are you excluding any consideration of your diagnosis? Are you excluding everything you know about his past patterns of behavior, his past sexually violently assaultive offenses? Are you excluding everything he told you during your interviews with him, in which he showed a consistent pattern of denying at least the sexual aspects of his conduct and minimizing those? Are you excluding all of your training as a clinical psychologist, just all of your education, all of your experience? He never said he was excluding all of that, and for the Court of Appeals to say that we have to read this statement as being in isolation from all that, and that all of his history, his diagnosis, his patterns of behavior, his interviews with the doctor, all of that has nothing to do with the doctor's opinion, is just not a reasonable reading of this record.
Counsel,
I wonder why we're here. And I wonder that because of your response in part to the chief's question. She asked essentially, what is the issue? Why are we here? And you had a few questions and answers back and forth. But you then responded as to what you saw the real issue. And you said whether the trial court erred in
concluding it could not find probable cause without independent evidence. I believe that to be essentially the same question that was certified to us at an earlier stage of this case. Is my belief correct?
Not entirely, and I think I may have either misspoken or not quite answered the question that was being asked earlier from the chief. I think the issue that I said was the issue is the issue in this case, and the Court of Appeals got away from that issue
okay.
in its opinion.
Right.
Why we're here is because the Court of Appeals' opinion injects some serious errors in the way that of evidence law in Wisconsin.
Okay, let's take a look at that then. We have the Court of Appeals' opinion, and if I recall the Court of Appeals' opinion, it perhaps, according to you, erred in saying, look, he wasn't testifying as an expert. So that's an evidentiary problem that causes my heart to pound because maybe they're wrong. So let's clear that up. Then they say it's not reasonably relied upon, and that's maybe causes my heart to pound, so let's clear it up. But after we clear up, from your perspective, those evidentiary errors made by the Court of Appeals, we are faced with the same question that you responded to the chief was the ultimate issue here, that was the certification question a while ago, and it's essentially the same question, and we've already, if you will, split on that question. I mean, so clear up this evidentiary problem. Clear up this evidentiary problem. Now let's get to the meat of it, and the meat of it is the same one certified question that was filed with this court on August 15th, 1996. Am I incorrect in that?
Well, with all due respect, I think it is important that we now have this intervening Court of Appeals decision that needs to be clarified for the benefit
that
of...
It needs to be cleaned up from your perspective.
Needs to be corrected and clarified.
Okay. But as to the real issue, once we take care of, from your perspective, the erroneous statements of evidentiary law, the real issue is the same issue, and as they used to say in the trial court, yes or no.
No, I would say it's not the same issue.
Why don't you state the issue again as you see it?
Well, I see the primary issue as whether the trial court erred in refusing to find probable cause on the stated ground that although the expert opinion was properly admitted, that she could not rely on the expert opinion because the underlying information that the expert relied on in forming his opinion had not been admitted into evidence. I further see the issues as whether the Court of Appeals was incorrect in concluding that this was not an expert opinion because Dr. Ahlhaus was not testifying as an expert on that subject of sexual motivation because he was relying on a hearsay statement that the Court of Appeals said, we think this is not the kind of information that experts reasonably rely upon in the field, and further, that it was improper because in finding sexual motivation, the doctor implicitly accepted the truth that the statement had been made. And the court said, we don't allow experts to make those kind of credibility determinations. That's for the finder of fact. And those are serious, serious misconstructions of Wisconsin evidence law.
Well, didn't the expert here have to assume the truthfulness of that statement allegedly made by the defendant in order to reach his conclusion?
He said that he did assume the truthfulness of the statement. He was aware that Mr. Watson had denied making the statement both back in 1980 at the time of sentencing and when he discussed the situation, discussed it with him during the interview. So he evaluated it and weighed that into his conclusion. The same thing, however, can be said of his diagnosis of paraphilia. Mr. Watson denied the sexual aspects of his earlier offenses, and as to one offense, he said, oh, it's just a joke that went too far. It's not uncommon that people who have been convicted of offenses, sexual predators, will deny that they did the offenses at all, notwithstanding they may have pled guilty. So in making a diagnosis which is based on a pattern of behavior, the psychologist obviously has to assume that the pattern of behavior occurred. That's part and parcel of what they do.
What's the burden on the state at this point, Ms. Wellman? Is the burden to prove that the statement was made, or is the burden to simply show that it appeared in a PSI, pre-sentence investigation report, and whether, and if the chances are 50-50 that it was made, it may have been made, it was made or it wasn't made, isn't that enough just for purposes of the preliminary examination?
It's certainly enough for those purposes. I don't think we even have to show that the statement was made. What we have to show is that we have an expert opinion that's sufficiently reliable to come before the trier of fact. The trier of fact can rely on the opinion in forming its conclusion on the various aspects of the case.
Would it make a difference if this was a trial to a jury? And we got the exact same facts. All we've got is a hearsay statement contained within a PSI. Would that be sufficient in a trial to allow the expert to testify as to his opinion?
The doctor's opinion would be admissible at trial, and his opinion would be sufficient if a jury found it to be reliable and credible for the jury or fact finder to rely on in returning a verdict, just as they may rely on the opinion that this man suffers a mental disorder.
Are you saying that the state would not have to prove that the statement was made, but only prove that the statement appeared in a PSI?
We wouldn't even have to prove that the statement appeared in the PSI. We could, and the trial court, in its discretion, could say, Mr. Prosecutor, I think it's too prejudicial to allow the jury to hear all of the details of this information. I want you to put your case in by just asking the doctor generally, have you looked at information? Have you considered information in the file, including information about his past offenses? Do you have an opinion? Yes, I have an opinion to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty. What is that opinion? And he gives his opinion. So the concern about whether the underlying evidence, information, comes in before the jury is a separate question. It's a separate question from whether the expert's opinion comes in, and a separate question from whether the trial, the court, or the expert basically determines whether there's reasonable reliance on certain kinds of information.
But,
and I think that gets conflated sometimes.
But what a terrible burden you're placing on a defendant, then. The defendant is having to test the accuracy of an expert opinion based upon a statement that's not even in evidence.
That's what the rules of evidence provide for.
Well, is that fair?
He can do that by cross-examination.
But yeah. By cross-examination, then the defendant himself is going to have to bring out what the statement was in order to have any kind of an effective cross-examination.
I don't know if that's not necessarily true. I think you could ask the expert, isn't it true that your information is based upon statements made of others that you've read in reports or files or materials or whatever kinds of information you've relied on? Isn't it true that you were not there? Isn't it true that you don't know, da-da-da-da-da? I think you can do cross-examination without bringing in the statement per se. But nonetheless, I mean, that is what 90703 provides for. And the reason it provides for it, I think there's this concern underlying all of this, that because the statement may not be admissible under the hearsay rules, it may or may not be, depending on other factors, but all of the information that he relies on may or may not come in, that it's by definition then untrustworthy. And that's wrong. I'm sorry.
90703, which says in its second sentence, if of a type reasonably relied upon by experts in the particular field in forming opinions. What kind of expertise does this doctor have in judging the truthfulness or lack of truthfulness of a victim or of a defendant? Is that reasonably relied upon? Or are you saying that you can put anything into a PSI and the expert can rely upon it for its truthfulness, so long as it's somewhat reasonable, so long as it's not something like saying the world is flat?
With all due respect, you're asking the wrong question. The question isn't what is his expertise in deciding whether to believe the victim or not. The question is, what is his expertise as a clinical psychologist in reviewing file materials, interviewing a person, materials that may well include either PSI information or other kinds of report information, which may include reports of what people familiar with the subject of the proceedings said or did, how he acted, how he behaved. And that's what clinical psychologists look at. They look at all that kind of information, and they do so with the filter of knowing, yeah, there may be some reason that this family wants to institutionalize this guy, so I'll look at that with a grain of salt. Dr. Althaus's testimony indicated he was aware that Mr. Watson denied the statement. He also had the information that in his interviews with him that was consistent with his denial of other sexual aspects of his conduct of which he had been proven guilty or had pled guilty. So the doctor was in a position to weigh that and take that into account. And all we asked for in 90703 is that there be a reliable enough basis for the doctor to base his opinion in the practice in the field. And if there is, then that's reliable enough to come into court and to allow fact finders to rely on it.
Ms. Wellman, let me interrupt and ask you, you're talking about the interview the doctor had with Mr. Watson. There was some reference earlier to some testing that went on, a sharp test.
It's the hair psychopathology test. I think I'm pronouncing it right. It's not actually a test, but based on everything he knows about Mr. Watson, it's an assessment that the clinician himself fills out. I think he gives certain points for certain pieces of information, and then based on the result of that, the person can be characterized as being highly psychopathic or medium or, you know, or different ranges.
And Dr. Althaus did that in this particular case?
Yes, he did. He did.
And was that in evidence? Was that presented to Judge Bartel?
I don't believe the test results per se were, but he testified that he had done this assessment and that Mr. Watson tested very high or was evaluated. Evaluated very high.
Counsel, what is the expert supposed to testify to? Let us just assume, let's not take Mr. Watson, but let's take another defendant. And let's assume that the doctor is now persuaded, regardless of the offense charge, that he is a sexual predator. That is, he's going to recommit a sexual offense. Is that enough to get him out under the Sexual Predator Act?
Well, he has to have been convicted.
That's right. But, and he has to be convicted of a particular offense. So isn't the expert witness testifying as to that offense here, that offense was sexually motivated, and regardless of what the condition of this defendant is at a later time, is that relevant?
I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. I'm sorry.
Isn't the key issue in this case whether or not he was convicted of an offense sexually motivated? Because false imprisonment doesn't fall under the statute.
It falls into the statute only if it was sexually motivated.
Only if it's sexually motivated. Okay. So does it matter what his condition now is, his psychological condition, at this probable cause hearing? At the probable cause hearing. I mean, what are we looking for? Just to see whether he's been convicted of a...
The expert also has to find that he currently suffers a mental disorder that falls within the terms of the statute. And he did so find.
But you have to separate out those two things, right?
That's right. Well, you separate them out. They both, one decision may well inform the other. And I think when Dr. Althaus said he considered all of the materials he reviewed, his experience, his training, his education, et cetera, there's no question that he was considering, as part of that, his diagnosis.
Okay, so if he had a false imprisonment and no victim statement here, victim didn't say anything, and he's now examined and they find that he is now suffering from a disease, you can relate that back to the false imprisonment? That would be adequate enough for you.
Yes, I think
that's your position, isn't it?
Yes, I think the doctor can offer an opinion that past conduct was sexually motivated based on everything that he knows about him, his diagnosis, his past history.
And your position is that's what very well could have happened here. In fact, it probably did, and you could take out the victim statement and the doctor would have gotten to the same result.
Well, he said that he could not reach that conclusion on sexual motivation without the statement. That doesn't mean, however, that a fact finder couldn't or that another expert wouldn't. It also, when he says that, he's saying it's necessary to my opinion. That's not the same as saying it's the sole basis of my opinion. And I think the Court of Appeals treated those interchangeably.
Thank you. Ms. Wellman.
Chief Justice, may I?
Sorry. Justice Prosser.
Certainly.
When Judge Bartel dismissed the petition, could the state have refiled under the law?
I don't think that we have any case law establishing that yet, but assuming that we're all correct in our assumption that it's analogous to a criminal offense, then I think they could recharge and bring in additional evidence. Obviously, obviously the state, and on this record we don't know if the victim is available or not, but even if she were, obviously the state does not want to have to put victims through testifying about these kinds of horrendous offenses at the probable cause hearing unnecessarily.
Justice Wilcox.
Ms. Wellman, you said that Dr. Althaus would have to rule out his opinion, and I had a different take on this, and I'm referring to your brief, page 14. And the question was, and I don't want to read it in full, but I'll read just part. Does that change your opinion if you exclude the information from the PSI? And the doctor said, yes. And how does it affect your opinion? Well, I would say it would be less substantial, but I wouldn't rule it out. Now, I took that to mean that he still would have the opinion, but not as substantial, dealing with there was substantial probability. I'm talking about.
Right. On the substantial probability part, I absolutely agree. I was only saying that on the part of the sexual motivation itself, when he was asked on cross-examination, and this is at page 66 and 67 of the record.
It's at page 15 of your brief.
15 of my brief, yes, right. Thank you. That if you didn't have this statement for purpose of sexual motivation, that's where he said it would be virtually impossible.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wellman. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Richard D. Martin, Assistant State Public Defender, representing John J. Watson.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. I am Richard Martin, Assistant State Public Defender, and I do represent Mr. Watson. Before I begin my presentation, I would like to try to respond to some of the questions the court has posed. To Ms. Wellman, and I'll take them in reverse order while they're still fresh in my mind, starting with Justice Wilcox's last question with regard to something being less likely. I think it's very important to keep in mind that refers to the likelihood of committing another sexual offense, another sexually violent offense. And that's very crucial because to get jurisdiction over Mr. Watson, first the state has to show that he committed a prior sexually violent offense. And that's one of either the enumerated offenses or one which is sexually motivated, as the court knows. And that is where his testimony is absolutely crucial, that he said that without this statement, it would be, quote, virtually impossible to draw a conclusion this was sexually motivated. This goes right into a really key point in this case, which is the Court of Appeals did not say that Dr. Althaus considered this statement in isolation from the other evidence. What they said was that his conclusion rested on the statement. And that's what Dr. Althaus said. He said, I've looked at everything else. I've looked at his prior offenses. I've looked at the facts of these offenses. I've looked at his records in the prison. And none of that is sufficient to convince me that this is sexually motivated without the addition of this alleged statement, which is means that it is necessary. This is necessary for the state's case, this alleged statement. Without it, they have no case. And their own expert said that.
Seems to me, Mr. Martin, you and Ms. Wellman disagree as to how to interpret the expert witness's statements.
Well, we absolutely do, Judge, and Chief Justice Abrahamson, and that's also key to this, because I don't think, as I've said repeatedly in my brief, and as the Court of Appeals agreed, that Dr. Althaus was testifying as an expert at all. He was being used as a conduit by the state to get into the record inadmissible hearsay, which has never been tested in any forum. And this goes to a couple of the questions that came up. It is in the record, and I think it's in
Mr. Martin, let me interrupt you for a minute. Is that indeed correct? Did this information come out on cross-examination of the expert, or did it come out in the state's case in chief on probable cause?
You mean the statement from Mr. Watson?
Right.
I believe it came out in his testimony in chief, as he's explaining the basis for his conclusion.
And he was asked by the state to do that?
That's right. Now, what did come out in cross-examination was, is that, does your opinion depend on that? Does it rest on that? And that's where the answer, without it would be virtually impossible, that came out in cross-examination. But the statement was elicited in the state's case in chief. And as I started to say, this statement has never been tested in any form. It's never been given under oath by the victim in this case. I believe Justice Prosser asked if there had been a preliminary hearing in this case. I think the record is silent. However, looking at the totality of the record, there was a very quick guilty plea to all of the charged offenses, There was no plea bargain in this case. Mr. Watson pled to everything with which he was charged. The sentencing transcript, which is in the record, reveals that he waived his revocation hearing. He was on parole at the time. There's another question about where the statement first appeared.
Before you get to that question, finish that.
To say, the statement did appear first in, I believe, a handwritten statement that the victim proffered to the author of the pre-sentence report. And another reason why I concluded there was no prelim in this case was that at the sentencing, the defense counsel told Judge Bartel that he'd only had a limited opportunity to review the pre-sentence with Mr. Watson because under the rules in Dane County at that time in 1980, he couldn't take it out of the court. And so Judge, and with that limited review, he couldn't take the pre-sentence report out of Judge Bartel's courtroom. And he'd only had a limited opportunity to go through it with Mr. Watson. And with that limited opportunity, he wanted to challenge a couple things, which are not germane to this case for the court. Then Judge Bartel afforded him additional time in the courtroom with Mr. Watson to go through it. That's the first time Mr. Watson ever saw this statement. And as the record reveals, the sentencing transcript, which is in the record, he vigorously and immediately said, I didn't say that. And he made that clear through his counsel and through his own words. He didn't say that, which leads me to believe that there was no preliminary hearing here. Because if there had been and the victim had testified along these lines, he would have been apprised of it long before.
Mr. Martin, you've heard the state its belief as to what Section 90703 means. And it does say right there that the data need not, or fact need not be admissible in evidence. It says if of a type reasonably relied upon by experts in a particular field in forming opinion. Well, what does 90703 mean if it doesn't mean exactly what the state says?
Well, it does mean that an expert may take all sorts of inadmissible evidence and use it and synthesize it.
Such as?
Medical records, prison records, police reports, treatment summaries, all sorts of inadmissible evidence. The expert may cull through it all, may synthesize it, may come to conclusions, and proffer those conclusions in court. That's what it means.
Then what does it not mean with respect to the statement?
What it does not mean is that the evidence, the inadmissible evidence, I hesitate to call it evidence, the statements themselves are not admissible for their truth. And Dr. Althaus was not testifying as an expert when he used this information. This statement, which the state in its first brief in this court cited 13 times, in which the court well knows what was in the statement, you don't need an expert to tell you what this statement is. Is simply not the thing you need an expert to tell a jury what it means.
So you're getting away from my question. What does this, I mean, the 90703 says that it need not be admissible in evidence.
Right.
Now, this hearsay statement obviously was not admissible in evidence.
Right.
So, but why can't he rely on it?
He can rely on it in reaching a conclusion. And I agree. An expert can rely on such evidence in reaching a conclusion.
Can or can't?
Can.
C-A-N or C-A-N-T?
C-A-N.
Okay.
C-A-N. Yes.
But that seems to not support your position, and that's what's bothering.
Could you?
Sure, me and Justice Babbitt.
Right.
If he can rely on the PSI, then what's your objection?
The assumption in our Section 90703 and in the Federal Rule 90703 is an expert brings special tools and expertise and knowledge and training to this evidence and this material, which allows him to go through it and examine it and make judgments about it and then proffer to the court information. What the state is asking this court to do is to allow an expert to do something which a defendant would never be allowed to do, which is simply be a conduit for its theory of the case, bringing no added value to the statement. An expert takes information, synthesizes it, and brings the added value of his training and expertise, and then proffers it to the finder of fact and says, here's my diagnosis. That's not what the state's expert did in this case.
Well, the trial court found that the state presented an expert who was a psychologist. The trial court found that this person was an expert witness. The trial court found that the expertise of this witness was to assess human behavior. And based on that expertise, the expert offered an opinion that his behavior in the false imprisonment was sexually motivated. So you disagree with those findings of the trial court that this witness testified as an expert witness,
No, I don't. The Well, yes, I do, to the limited extent that the trial court didn't, as a respondent, I'm allowed to raise any ground in support of the trial court's ruling, and the trial court did not reach this rationale I've articulated, in which the Court of Appeals accepted. The trial court ruled that the evidence was hearsay, the evidence was not properly before it, and that the naked opinion standing alone did not meet the state's burden.
The trial court also found this was an expert witness testifying as an expert. Do you disagree with that assessment of what the trial court found?
An expert testifying as an expert does not always offer expert testimony.
Let me be more specific. Do you agree, not with the finding, but do you agree that's what the trial court found in this case, that this was an expert testifying as an expert witness? Do you agree that was, whether wrongly or correctly, the finding of the trial court?
Well, I agree in part that the record is a bit muddled here, because at one point the state said, I'm not asking him this question as regards sexual motivation as an expert. He said, I'm asking it in the way any layman could tell us what it means. I mean, the prosecutor said that. And so when that question was asked, he said, I'm not asking him as an expert. So it really is a bit of a muddled record here, and there are a plethora of hearings here and a plethora of expounding by the trial court on its ruling. Okay. Now, I agree that the trial court accepted Dr. Althaus as an expert. I think the trial court did not engage in the analysis I'm bringing to the court today, but I think that analysis is crucial, because the state is asking you to allow it to use an expert to basically assess credibility. And the point I wanted to make before is that the rationale behind 90703 and the federal rule 703 is that an expert brings better tools than a layperson to his inquiry. But this is exactly the kind of inquiry that this court and the Court of Appeals have repeatedly said that experts are not allowed to do. Experts can't make credibility determinations. Experts are no better equipped than this court, the Court of Appeals, the trial court, to know what the meaning of that statement is, nor is an expert better equipped than anybody in this room to know what the meaning of that statement was. That's my point.
I'm looking at page 7 of the Court of Appeals decision. Page 7 says that, indeed, when Watson's counsel objected to the question eliciting Dr. Althaus's opinion, and the opinion is based on the hearsay statement, the victim's hearsay statement, the prosecutor, even though having just phrased the question in terms of expert opinion, argued to the court that it was not, quote, it is not an opinion that an expert need make. An ordinary citizen can draw such a conclusion as I'm asking Dr. Althaus to draw. That's your point. Is that
right?
Exactly
the language I was alluding to. You just said, perhaps.
Well, then, further on this page, the Court of Appeals analyzes 90703, but not in the way you have, and I have not checked on this, but the Court of Appeals looks to Charles McCormick's rule of evidence to explain why 90703 was changed to the way it was, because, as we've agreed, the old law was this would not have been good. And here they say that what 90703 refers to is special kinds of material that the defendant, that an expert witness would look at. And they apparently conclude, when I look at 107 and 108, that the pre-sentence investigation report is not such material. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. I think that's exactly right, and I think that's right for this reason. On the one hand, the state argues in its brief, and they come out, the state says this very clearly, that the experts are better equipped than judges to tell us what this statement means. Yet, at another point in its brief, the state tells us how reliable pre-sentence reports are and how carefully they're prepared and how judges rely on them at sentencing to make very weighty decisions, and that these pre-sentence reports then follow the individual to prison, and where the prison authorities rely on these reports to make similarly weighty decisions. So on the one hand, on the one hand, a judge is perfectly adequate and able to read and understand and make sense of a pre-sentence report at sentencing. But somehow, in a Chapter 980 proceeding, we need the vaunted expert to come in and tell us what this 13-word statement means, and I don't think that makes any sense at all. But that's what the state's trying to get this court to approve. Justice Prosser asked a question about whether the state could have refiled, and I just want to point out, because this case has a long procedural background. In fact, First of all, the underlying offense goes back to 1980 when Jimmy Carter was still president and I still had all my hair. But the appellate background of this case predates Justice Prosser's involvement with the court. And in fact, the state did refile this case once before. The state filed a petition. There was an initial hearing. Judge Bartel dismissed it, finding the petition itself did not confer jurisdiction. The state got leave of this court to refile. So even then, Judge Bartel had invited the state to make the evidentiary showing, which was failing or refusing to make by bringing in the victim. And they've never done so. But there was actually a dismissal of the first petition and a refiling of the second petition, and this court gave its imprimatur to that. So,
Mr. Martin, let me preface my question by saying that I tend to agree that 90703 doesn't go as far as the state argues it goes, because I think there's things within PSIs or anything else that an expert can't be reasonably expected to rely upon. But let's assume for purposes of this case that in cross-examination or direct examination, the question was asked of the doctor, well, doctor, because I think implicitly it was, do you base your opinion upon the truthfulness of that statement? And the doctor says, I base my opinion on the statement which I assume is true. He simply says, I assume it's true. If it's not true, then of course my opinion flies out the window. He did say that. So implicitly he's saying, I assume that it's true. For purposes of a bindover and a preliminary examination, why isn't that sufficient?
Because
the state is entitled to all reasonable inferences.
Because
correct?
That delegates the minimal gatekeeping function of a probable cause or a preliminary hearing proceeding to the expert rather than the court. You could bring a police officer in a sexual assault case, and he could say, in my opinion, she was sexually assaulted. I've been on the sexual assault unit for 11 years. I interviewed that victim. They don't bring the victim in. They just bring in the detective. And he says, I interviewed her. In my opinion, she was sexually assaulted. And how is that different than what we have here? Dr. Althaus was asked very carefully, when there was a dispute between the victim and Mr. Watson, did you simply assume that Mr. Watson was not being truthful when he admitted that he did? This again goes to what an expert does. He was asked whether he made any attempt either to independently corroborate the information he was relying on or to examine it or determine its accuracy, and he admitted he didn't. He just simply took it at face value.
But why is that different from what you say admittedly can come in? That's hearsay, that's uncross-examined hearsay, like medical records. Why is that different? I mean, the expert is assuming that the accuracy of the medical records.
But those are prepared and relied on by the treatment personnel all along the line of someone who is being treated for a condition, whether psychological or physical, and they're being prepared for a specific purpose. And all this excessive treatment personnel will rely on them. Here you've got a situation where a report is prepared for a sentencing court. And when the defendant first hears about the allegation, he challenges it immediately. Judge Bartel, back in 1980, who had intimate involvement with this case, who did take the plea, and that's in the record of the sentencing. She took the plea, she did the sentencing, she heard, observed the defendant in her court, she heard the actors in this case, and Judge Bartel declined to try to resolve the conflict back in 1980. She didn't feel it was necessary to resolve it, and I think she almost implicitly is saying it wasn't resolvable.
Are you saying that the normal indicia of reliability, which is assumed in 90703, is not present in this statement?
Yes, I am.
That's your argument?
That's part of my argument, yes.
And that's the other part.
Well, the expert did not bring to bear any expertise in assessing the statement. He just simply accepted that it was made, assumed that it was true, used it along with, and I agree that he used it along with the other evidence, to say that it's sexually motivated. But if you strike the statement from all the other evidence, the defendant's background, his prior offenses, and the facts of this case, then he said, and this is the state's expert, it would be almost impossible to conclude this offense was sexually motivated. And it's important to keep in mind, we're talking about two different assaults on the morning January 1980 of two different innocent young women, and one of whom, sua sponte, volunteered that she did not think it was sexually motivated. She said he did nothing sexual, said nothing sexual. There was nothing about his approach or manner that made her think it was sexual.
And
it's interesting that the state never charged an attempted sexual assault, never charged a sexual assault. The prosecutor at the original sentencing said these assaults were without purpose. So in 1980, the prosecutor didn't see a sexual motivation here. One of the state's own victims eschewed any idea there was a sexual motivation. It was only after the plea, right before the sentencing, when the other victim comes up with this allegation.
And was all that in the record?
That is all in the record. And there are also things in the record about a civil suit pursued by the victim. That's in some of the submissions of the defense counsel at the trial level. There's a long motion to dismiss, about 26 or so pages. And in there, she alludes to the fact that there was a civil suit filed by this victim against Mr. Watson, the department, the probation and parole agent, a whole host of actors.
Counsel, earlier you mentioned this statement, which is a subject of our discussion. It's a handwritten statement given to the author of the pre-sentence. Mm-hmm. Is there any indication in the record that the author of the pre-sentence interviewed the victim?
I don't think so. My best recollection is there's not.
So, is it in the record that the genesis of this, that this statement first came to light in this case as a handwritten statement presented to the author of the pre-sentence by the victim and some way got to the author of the pre-sentence? Is that what you are saying the record reflects?
That's my best recollection, and during this Ronald's last 5 minutes, I'll be glad to check the pre-sentence itself, but the pre-sentence would answer that question, and that is in the record. It's one of the state's exhibits at its probable cause hearing. But my recollection is that the author of the pre-sentence simply said, I've gotten this written statement from the victim, and I did not get any sense that he had also independently interviewed her. I could be wrong.
In some ways, I see this as a sufficiency of evidence case. And you have a trial judge saying, look, I mean, from what you're suggesting now, you have a trial judge who says, I was at the plea, I was at the sentencing, there was nothing that was charged or nothing that was said that indicated there was any sexual contact or attempt at sexual contact. The record reflects that the guy's been incarcerated for 15 years and never treated as though he were a sexual offender. And if what you're saying is that the statement upon which the expert relies is the handwritten statement that some way got to the author of the pre-sentence, it seems to me that it's kind of a totality of the evidence, that if you look at all of this evidence, and on the other side you have a 2.5-hour interview with the defendant by the expert, and you have reviewing the pre-sentence and Department of Corrections stuff, and you have a trial court judge saying, look, I'm weighing all of this evidence, and there is not a sufficient showing of probable cause. Now, am I wrong in saying this is a sufficiency of evidence case, or am I correct? Do you agree with that?
I think that's part of the case. I think that's an interesting way of analyzing it. I think that Judge Bartel did in fact rule that there was no admissible evidence in her record to bind over, to use the criminal phrase, this case. And she said that the expert's testimony without supporting admissible evidence alone was not enough for a bind over.
She also said there wasn't enough weight to bind over.
I think that's right. And again, I think it is important to emphasize, as you just did, that her lengthy involvement with this case, with this defendant, with these set of facts. I mean, she was both the trial judge and the Chapter 90 judge. I think that's very helpful to the court. I think it's interesting, in the state's brief, which exceeds, with the court's permission, the page limit, there was no mention of the standard of review that this court employs in evidence questions. It's a discretionary standard. It's been called a limited right to be wrong. If standards of review mean anything, it seems to me that we should at least pay lip service to it and at least give Judge Bartel some credit for the rulings that she enunciated and discuss them under the correct standard, which is the discretionary standard. And I think here there's an abundance of discretion exercised by Judge Martel, drawing on her firsthand experience with this case and knowledge
of it. Counsel, perhaps, at least as the state argues, she misapplied the law in requiring the underlying evidence to be independently admissible. And if that is, erroneous evidentiary ruling, then you would agree that it's the standard is erroneous exercise of discretion.
Sure. A decision based on error of law is itself an erroneous exercise of discretion. That's correct. But here, I don't think she did. I think that she correctly applied the law. I think there's an assumption being made here that somehow the opinion itself is enough to carry the day, either in a probable cause hearing or in a trial. I think it's important to keep in mind that we're talking about both things. So there's nothing that I can see in the state's arguments, and it virtually conceded at oral arguments today, that would not also allow the state to then seek to admit this at a trial. And these cases, as I'm sure the court understands, are very emotionally and very difficult cases in lots of ways to litigate. And here, the state is suggesting that it can commit Mr. Watson potentially for the rest of his life based on an out-of-court, unsworn, classic hearsay statement.
Mr. Martin, the expert, what evidence did the expert have describing the true false imprisonments?
Well, he testified, I believe, that he reviewed the criminal complaint, that he reviewed the pre-sentence report. I think he had access to the sentencing. I think he testified he reviewed the file in the prison, which would include the sentencing transcript. And I think he also testified he discussed the offense. Well, of course he testified he discussed the offense with Mr. Watson, because Mr. Watson, of course, denied that particular statement.
Suppose the statement at issue here had been contained in the criminal complaint. Could the expert have relied on it in that situation?
I don't think that gives any added issue of worth or value. No, I don't think so. I think if the statement had been made under oath at some juncture, a revocation hearing, a preliminary hearing, some sort of proceeding where it was made under oath and subject to some limited testing, even a limited testing or preliminary hearing, the state would have an argument that we've got some indicia of trustworthiness here. But here you've got a classic out-of-court hearsay statement.
Did you make a comment before that someone evaluated these two false imprisonments as being false imprisonments without purpose?
The prosecutor used that language at sentencing. I can give you the site if you want, but I don't have it right at my fingertips, but at the sentencing, the prosecutor was discussing how violent these were, and he said they were without purpose. And this was a prosecutor who also knew this case well, who prosecuted this defendant in this case, and who had been privy to that pre-sentence report. So either he read what she said and didn't accept it, he read it, he didn't think it was significant, he obviously would have interviewed the victim at some point in the course of this proceeding and made a judgment not to charge any sexual assaults or attempted sexual assaults or anything.
Is there any suggestion that Mr. Watson took anything from either of these victims?
Not to my knowledge. In both instances, the victims escaped. But I don't think there was any suggestion of...
Both false imprisonments occurred on the same day?
Within an hour or two of each other, both in Madison, one, I believe, in the Arboretum, and one in the South Beltline somewhere.
What... Can you imagine any purpose for a false imprisonment of a young woman other than taking property or some sexual purpose?
Unfortunately, I can. I can imagine all sorts of horrible purposes and torture, murder, all kinds of things that are not sexual at all. And without, without some indication what the purpose is, I don't think we can just impute one. And one of the victims who had firsthand the very unpleasant firsthand experience of being on the receiving end of these blows that were inflicted on her said, I don't think there was a sexual purpose. And I submit that that's at least worthy of this court's consideration in assessing what value it wants to give to the other statement. You asked me about a criminal complaint, whether if the statement was contained therein, that might be somewhat more valuable. I would just say that if it was in the criminal complaint, if the defendant had notice within the criminal complaint, and if he then stipulated as part of a plea agreement that the facts in the criminal complaint were true, then of course it would have a whole different value to it. But that's not what happened here. What happened here is it was in the pre-sentence, he sees it at the 11th hour at sentencing at counsel table for the first time and says, I didn't say that. And this is, I think this court, it would be helpful for the court to review the sentencing transcript to a certain extent, because this defendant was extremely forthcoming, articulate, took full responsibility for what he had done, expressed remorse, which the trial court took as a sincere expression of remorse. He actually went out of his way to praise the prosecutor for taking his job so seriously, because the prosecutor had been, I think, the subject of some criticism. I'm not sure what it all was, but in the press, he praised the prosecutor for doing a good job and for being fair. So this is a very articulate defendant, and I think that, again, it goes to the whole picture of Judge Bartel having presided over that proceeding and seeing that package of facts and deciding that this one alleged statement, which has never been tested, could not get a bind over. And again, as the state has basically said today, the state thinks they can use this at a trial without ever getting it admitted properly. And simply, the expert says, I think this is sexually motivated, and that's enough. And if the defendant wants to cross-examine about the basis of it, then it'll come in, and then the jury will be told, well, it's not admissible for the truth of it, but it's the basis of his testimony. But as I understand the jury instructions on expert testimony, and as I understand the law in the state, an expert can testify either as to an ultimate issue if the facts are uncontroverted, or in the form of a hypothetical if they are controverted. And then the jury is told, you must decide, if you find these facts to be true, then you can credit his opinion, and if you don't, you don't. And that's what Judge Bartel is saying here, and I think that she said it repeatedly in different ways, which is this is not the way we prove up factual and evidentiary matters in our courts.
Is there a police report or two police reports anywhere in the record?
I don't think so. I'll be glad to check that and write the court letter if you want. I don't think so. The criminal complaint is fairly lengthy. It was in the appendix of my first brief in this court, I think. And there may be some materials buried. I don't think so. Oh, may I just make one last point? This Hari psychopathy test was alluded to, I think, in a question that Justice Crooks asked of Dr. Althaus's testimony. And there's also record evidence, transcript number 65 and 66, where Dr. Beebe, who was a defense expert, testified that he went back and looked at Dr. Althaus's scoring, and he made a mathematical error. The number that he testified... Dr. Althaus had made a mathematical adding error, so when he gave a testimony that he met a certain...